and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. This is Irreverent, Faith and Current Affairs.
Welcome to Irreverent, Faith and Current Affairs. Three vicars in the Church of England commenting on the state of the world. Me, Jamie Franklin, Daniel French and Thomas Pelham. We're all together again. What a lovely thing. So good to see you both. Let's come up to, on my screen, you're above me, Daniel. So I'll come to you first. How are you this day?
I'm fine, thanks. It's great to be on with all of us.
With the
Holy Spirit.
Well, no, Daniel.
Let's not be blasphemous, Daniel.
Blasphemy within 30 seconds, within 30 seconds of the recording beginning. Some rank heresy.
And I'm admiring Tom's background with these guitars.
It is looking increasingly like a music studio in Tom's vicarage.
I'll be releasing the album next month.
Are you actually doing some recording?
I can
picture you there, Tom, after hours, you know, with a glass of whiskey.
23.
your Fender Stratocaster in your hands.
Yeah,
it's not a Fender Stratocaster. What you call it? You know the ones. What are they called?
You've got
Squire Stratocaster.
Okay.
Yeah.
And one of them looks like a Les Paul, although it's so small on my screen, I can't.
It is a Epiphone Les Paul.
Yeah, they're good, actually. They're really good.
They're really nice.
I used to have an Epiphone. Well, I still have it, actually. I've got an Epiphone Flying V. And I used to have an Epiphone Explorer, which are the Z-shaped ones, back in the day.
They're basically not really usable as guitars. I mean, the Flying V, it's just unbalanced, isn't it?
What are you saying? Of course it's usable. It's awesome. It's amazing.
I should write some music. I haven't written music in such a long time. But I was a minister. I was a musician.
Well, you still are a musician, Tom.
I guess I am. Yeah,
A great musician.
That's very kind.
No, you are great, Tom.
Most
you
of my great. Talents are deployed on renditions of Bar Bar Black Sheep these days. But
well, everyone's got to find his limit. Yeah. Right, that's a joke, by the way. Tom is a far better musician than I am. Anyway, let's continue with the show. So for people who are new to this show, we're vicars, we're in the Church of England, we talk about faith and current affairs. We do it from a robust perspective, though. You know, there's no wishy-washiness here, or at least we try to avoid it. I was on the Unbelievable programme this week with John Stevens from the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches, talking about COVID and the church closures. So it was interesting to be on that show. Did you guys saw it, didn't you, Daniel? Did you see it, Tom?
I've sort of read your update, you know, your thoughts on it, but I haven't seen it.
Right. Okay. I thought it was quite a good discussion, actually. I mean, it wasn't like a full-blown debate. It was more like a kind of conversation. And I think it was right that was the case. We're coming at it from quite different perspectives in many ways. Obviously, John is like the head of a big organization and I'm simply a curate. So, you know, in that way, we're very different. And obviously, we have different perspectives on what the church should have done. But I'm going to put a link to the discussion on our show notes, which are beneath the video you're watching, or they'll be in your on the notes or your podcast. So if you'd like to see that video of me talking with John Stevens on Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio, you can go ahead and find that. So that was an interesting thing to tell people about. Any interesting things you want to say to anyone, Daniel?
Well,
or Tom?
I just concluded watching This England, the Kenneth
Brown. Oh, yeah. Right, yeah.
Of, the COVID drama and the, you know, the sort of early Johnson premiership. I have to say I wasn't massively convinced by it, though, in terms of the, you know, aesthetic, the special effects. I mean, boy, the makeup that they put that he put on and his take on Johnson was very good and funny,
right.
You know, very believable, but it was so interlaced with one side of the narrative, essentially the whole thing. Sorry, this is spoilers for folks who are
I mean, everyone kind of knows what happened, though, don't they?
I think it's fairly... No, but I mean, from the interior of the script is that, you know, ends with him and Dominic Cummings, you know, basically saying, if only we'd locked down sooner, harder, you know, and you think, oh, really? And it was just interlaced with lots of backstories, which I know they meant well, you know, various people and how they were affected by COVID and those who lived, those who died. But I just found it didn't work. Though the idea of Johnson wandering around 10 Downing Street, A, forgetting poo bags for his poodle all the time, being completely absent-minded and sort of screaming off bits of Latin and Cicero and what have you, was quite funny and very well done. And the speculation, unless they leaked, you know, that when he was in intensive care, he started gabbling Greek, you know, was well done and was amusing, you know, that at one point he's practically strapped to this bed thinking he's Augustus.
Daniel, is this England? This England, is that a quotation from? That's from a Shakespeare play, isn't it?
Which you know he quotes, but
which Shakespeare play is it? I can't remember. Is it Richard the Third? I think it might be Richard the Third. I can't quite remember. In fact, I can remember it said by John of Gaunt, but I can't remember in which play. The reason I remember that is because I remember listening to Patrick Stewart doing it on the BBC Hollow Crown, but I can't remember.
It's Richard the Second. A quick Google told me.
Richard the Second. There we are. Google has told you, Tom.
The clever thing about the whole thing is if you read beyond a few more lines of that poem, it's about a lost England.
Right.
So, you know, da-dum. But
what's the significance of that with regards to COVID then?
Well, I suppose it's new normal.
Right.
That he's lamenting that the sort of maybe the post-Brexit libertarian paradise that he expected didn't quite happen within a few weeks.
It didn't happen because he locked us all in our houses.
I mean,
he closed everyone's businesses down. That's why it didn't happen.
Disappointed that they didn't have someone playing the Archbishop of Canterbury in a kitchen.
So the Archbishop of Canterbury wasn't in it at all.
Yeah, it was really sad actually, because I thought that would have been, because there's a bit where, you know, he wakes up on Easter Day and, you know, Christ is risen. Oh, well, what do you think, Carrie? Oh. And I thought, oh, they were going to cut then to, you know, Justin breaking bread
on his kitchen counter
onto his Moulinex blender. But they didn't know.
What a surprise.
Maybe in the director's cut.
Yeah, I mean, what is it, interestingly, one of the things John Stevens said when we were talking is that the government just had basically very, very little concern at all for public worship continuing. They were far more concerned with businesses, music venues, and all this kind of stuff. And really, the church didn't play a role in their thinking at all.
The only thing about the Church of England, we've been in social distancing for the past 1,000 years.
I mean, yep.
Everyone sits at the back of the church.
Well,
and be chummy and what have you.
Well, that's why the church should have just stayed open and basically nothing would have changed.
They did have one clip where in a mosque, and this is where I thought, oh, maybe they're going to do another clip within a church where the young mosque leader says that he's got a great empathy for all the elders, and so it's right and proper that they don't worship.
This narrative smells a little bit fishy to me.
Toby Young said it's basically propaganda.
It sounds like they're trying to it sounds like a message is being delivered, doesn't it?
They're quite open about Spivey and all of that,
Really. Yeah, interesting. Well, This England, you can check it out if you want on Sky Atlantic.
About Sky, you can fast forward bits quite quickly.
Well, yeah, I mean,
is it is six?
True of most TV these days.
6 hours of it, so I have to confess the the were bits that I did through.
Yeah, very good, very good. Cool. Well, one thing I wanted to do is just read a few messages from the Buy Me a Coffee people, because to be honest, we haven't done this for a few weeks and I can't remember which ones I've read, but it's nice to say thank you to people who have bought us virtual copies. Richard C said, loved your take on quotation Benito Meloni. Remember, the coffees must be espressos. Did we compare Meloni, or were we saying that people were comparing this Giorgio Meloni to Mussolini? I suppose maybe we talked about that last week. Our jokes are so legion that we can hardly even remember them. Denial. I wonder if that's a spelling mistake and it's meant to be Daniel. Says, thank you for your interesting podcast. Bless you all. Thank you very much. Paul G said, no, hang on. We definitely read that one. I remember that one. Deborah says, thank you for this podcast. It is enlightening to hear casual yet serious discussions about Christianity. Sar says, I look forward to your discussions every week. Thank you for what you're doing with this podcast. Well, we're very grateful to you. All you people buying us nice coffees, virtual coffees online. It's very kind of you. And if you'd like to leave a message for us and buy us a coffee, you can do it by going to our website, irreverentpod.com. But for now, we're going to do, as we are wont, a bit of scripture reading at the beginning of this, before we talk about the stories, the salient stories of the week. And today we're going to be reading from, we're going to be continuing in our series, because it is a series, on the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 5, verses 43 to 48. But first, we should say a little prayer, seeing as we are priests, after all. And I think we should say the Lord's Prayer. Now, Tom, when I ask you to do the Lord's Prayer, it's always slightly dodgy, because I never know quite what you're going to say. I never know what kind of version is going to come out. Are you up?
I'm glad you underlined that, actually.
Which combination of the Book of Common Prayer, the traditional version, and your own sort of eccentricity is going to happen? Do you want to have a go at it today?
I could do, yeah.
Go on, Tom. Come on.
I'm going to look it up so I don't get it wrong. Here we are.
All right.
Let's pray. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive them that trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
Amen.
A text which is within the Sermon on the Mount, which we're covering now.
That is true, actually, yeah.
It's not far away, is it?
Yeah, it's quite soon. Okay, so... Matthew chapter 5, verse 43, as Christ speaking in the Sermon on the Mount. I'm reading for the RSV, by the way, just in case anyone's interested. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you salute only your brethren, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Teaching of Christ there. Love your enemy. I was just looking up some quotations from the patristic fathers on this text, and I found one from Tertullian, who's, I think Tertullian was second century, wasn't he? It was very early.
He's not strictly a Christian father, is he? He's because he embraced a slightly wacky heresy at the end, and so it was slightly kind of... his middle writing's all right, but towards the end, he just goes off the rails.
Okay, well, thank you, Tom. My quotation after this is going to be from Origen, who presumably is even more controversial than Tertullian. But the first one... from Tertullian, he writes, to love friends is the custom for all people, but to love enemies is customary only for Christians. I'll read that again, sorry, I messed it up. To love friends is the custom for all people, but to love enemies is customary only for Christians. And it's, I think, it's certainly true that this sense that, you know, we should be kind and loving to our enemies is a profoundly Christian idea. And it's yet another one of those ideas which we take for granted in, you know, secular modernity, that this is sort of, you know, this is just something which is innate to humanity, to human ethics, that we should just love people who are our enemies. And, you know, it's good to be kind to people who oppose us and all this kind of stuff. But actually, this is not something that exists outside of cultures that have been influenced by Christianity, which is why Tertullian says this, you know, to love enemies is customary only for Christians, because it was this unique teaching of Christ at the time. So I thought that was interesting. And then the other thing, and this is, I wasn't joking when I said I was going to quote Origen, who is, of course, who was condemned as a heretic, but he is often quoted in these anthologies. And I do think he was a very great
theologian. He's a great thinker, yeah.
It's a complicated thing. And I'm sure that people listening to this are not doing so for a sort of a nuanced discussion of Origen. Origen is a second or third century. So it's very early Christian writer. But he writes, "The traces of the divine image are clearly recognized, not through the likeness of the body, which undergoes corruption, but through the intelligence of the soul. We see the divine image in its righteousness, temperance, courage, wisdom, discipline, and through the entire chorus of virtues that are present essentially in God. These can be in people through effort and the imitation of God, as also the Lord points out in the gospel when he says, 'Be merciful as your Father is merciful, and be perfect as your Father is perfect.'" And that's really the basis, isn't it, for the ethical teaching of Christ in this passage. He's not just saying, you know, do this sort of arbitrarily. You should love your enemies arbitrarily. He's saying you should do it because this is the way God is with the world. You know, he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. So because God is gracious and merciful and good to all people, this is what we are to do in imitation of God. So that's why Origen says, you know, it's the being like God is not being physically similar. It's the similarity of the soul to God. But one of the things I was thinking about, chaps, and I would value your input on this, is, you know, this show about current affairs, isn't it? And it's really hard to think through, you know, how to apply these principles in the cut and thrust of, you know, political debates and all of these things. We see a lot of hatred. We see a lot of vitriol being flung around. And sometimes as Christians, we get drawn into it as well. So anyway, I'm just be interested in your thoughts.
I just thought that key to what we're doing is, in the end, a resort to being magnanimous. That, particularly in the extremities of politics, which has sort of become so mainstream on social media, is this taking down and cancelling of anyone, you know, ad hominem attacks. That if someone disagrees with you, then they must be by nature a bad person, if that is the first step. I mean, you know, it's a sort of it's an unpicking of the great tapestry of Christian sentiment and culture that is what we're experiencing, isn't it? And the sort of post-Christianity is, yes, it's got all the soundings of inclusion and being nice to people and trying to promote equality. And yet, if you question certain aspects of the new orthodoxy, you're going to get taken down. And that's very difficult for us, because it would be easy, I think, to think, well, let's go hammer and tong at the opposition and pull them down. And berate them and treat them in the same way. And I feel that the gospel ultimately is saying to, you know, to Christians and to those who hold a conservative understanding of the world, don't do that. That actually you lose that seed of civilization within you if you do that. That's a very dangerous path, you know. And I think the danger is in some versions of populism, you can see this. It's certainly there, you know, on the left and the hard left and the woke and the progressivists, that to take down your enemy, to cancel them, is, you know, seen as virtuous. Whereas I think our way is not to be that. Even, you know, that we might lose in doing so, but not, I think, the profundity of really losing if we stop loving our enemies and our adversaries. I often say, I often say in our weekly and daily prayers that we say publicly in the church, we pray for the souls of the faithful departed, for loved ones, and even adversaries, as the final, you know, prayers that we're going to bring to the altar for the dead and the departed. You know, it's we're praying not only for our, you know, parents maybe who've departed from this life, but even those who have been, you know, a pain in the neck, those who've been adversarial.
I guess I take a slightly different view on it, because I don't actually have a problem with cancelling people from a Christian perspective, or at least not directly. And it is in, it depends what we mean by love, in a sense. I mean, love isn't to allow someone to just sort of take over an institution, for example, without challenging them, and even challenging them quite robustly, and even stopping them, you know, to love your enemies is not to it's not just to sort of say they're right, or that their position is. And I know you're not saying this, but it's not necessarily. I guess if you go back, I mean, what's the sort of origin of cancelling? You could say that there's a sense of the blasphemy laws of the sort of Christendom being a kind of cancelling, aren't they? They forbid people from speaking untruths. This is the idea. I don't know whether there's something inherently wrong with that, but it doesn't mean you don't love people who are doing the wrong things, even if you try and stop them from doing the wrong thing. Because certainly, like, praying for those who persecute you can be really hard, or blessing those who curse you is a really hard thing to do. But it's really important to do.
I think that thing about cancel culture, Tom, it's like, it's more than just, you know, opposing people who are saying wrong things or something like that. It's like, it's about sort of dividing humanity into the light and the dark, isn't it? And all the good and the evil. And when you do the slightest transgression, you're kind of placed in this, you know, you're placed in the bad category, and I think there's something profoundly un-Christian about that. Just to add as well, I think I see Christians doing this as well online. Perhaps I've done it in the past, you know, because we have the, you know, I'm not saying it's exactly the same thing, but, you know, guilt by association, or you might have said something which is, you know, indicates that you're in favor of some policy which is considered to be unacceptable, you know, around COVID or whatever it might be. And then you are placed in the category by your own side, if you like. And so that way of thinking about, like, humanity is like, well, there are good people and there are bad people. And, you know, if you do the wrong thing, then you're one of the bad people and you should be treated as though you're a sort of non-person. I think it happens on both sides. And it's a profoundly simplistic and uncharitable way of thinking about people. Sorry, Tom, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I sort of agree. But I sort of don't. I'm just trying to get my thoughts in order here, really. Let's take an example of the sort of liberalizing tendency within the Church of England. You know, I'd actually rather they weren't in the Church of England, and would quite happily have the Church of England authoritatively declare truth, as it has done over the years, and in theory still does, and say, well, if you don't want to engage with that truth, then please, you know, find a denomination where you're welcome to do that, but don't do it from the pulpit of a Church of England church. You know, and I'd say that, you know, if you were going to go for wild examples, I'd say that to someone who was an Arian, you know, who turned up and it was a Church of England minister who was an Arian, who was preaching the Christ wasn't divine. And there are some. I'd actually say to them, you know what, actually, not in the Church of England pulpit. Get out and stop preaching it. And is that cancelling?
I don't think I'm actually disputing that with you, Tom, in any way.
But I guess I wouldn't be not loving them. I'd try and persuade them of their error, and I'd quite happily welcome them into the church. But you know, to preach about why they're wrong, admittedly, at them. I kind of find it hard to distinguish that sort of, in a way that is cancelling. It's in the pre-modern time before Twitter, that is cancelling. That's taking away someone's Twitter profile, you know, their pulpit.
I don't think so, Tom. I think I think cancelling is a specific thing, which I was just trying to describe. It's different from just not giving somebody a platform. It's about trying to remove any sort of public influence or profile completely from that person based on, you know, transgressions of or perceived transgressions of political orthodoxy.
And it's also, I think, within cancel culture, an unforgiving culture where there is almost to a fault no route to redemption, forgiveness, or reconciliation.
Well, yeah, completely.
Which I don't think is of your nature. You know, I think for you to say discipline a colleague or to see or advocate for the disciplining of someone within the church because they have strayed into heresy is the kind of correct management of someone, but that you wouldn't presumably then destroy their character and say that's you damned for all eternity.
No. And
even if you turn it around, we're going to make sure by association that anyone who had anything to do with you is unsafe. That there's something kind of grueling in cancel culture, which also then has, by correspondence, a sort of self-righteousness to it, which ignores any possibility of nuance or each of us recognizing that, you know, to quote that Solzhenitsyn thing, you know, the problems of the worlds that run through the human heart, those conflicts, that we are conflicted in ourselves. I think what you find in the cancel culture zealots is that inability to, you know, stand before anything transcendent or anyone, because there isn't in their worldview often, and say, I potentially could be wrong and I potentially could be a monster.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's, but I know what you're saying.
I know you're not, but I'm just sort of
walkover.
I'm just trying to see where that line is, because I guess someone who you did that to, who, you know, your let's say, you know, Mark the Arian preaching from St. John's Church down the road, who you engineer out of his pulpit because has no right to be there. He might feel like he'd been cancelled, and I wonder where the moral difference is. That's what I'm saying.
That's a highly specific example, Tom, of the sort of criteria for a legitimate minister within the Church of England. I think the thing about the cancel culture is it's just so arbitrary, isn't it? It's something where, you know, what is acceptable to say one day is not acceptable to say the next. And you can even be sort of tried and convicted by cancel culture for something that when you said it was absolutely fine, but now is not. And it can be dug up 10 years later, and then you can sort of, you know, lose your job or, you know, lose your position and have your public profile removed and have your character besmirched and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you compared it to, some of the greats, you know, I think in the 20th century, who've promoted peace and reconciliation, acknowledging the difficulties and pains that people who are involved in horrific and dodgy regimes. I'm thinking of the Enniskillen bombing, when the father who lost his daughter, you know, I mean, I watched that live, on the news, you know, and he came out and said, after the IRA had killed his daughter, that he could but only forgive his enemies.
Mm.
You know, and that's an extraordinary thing. Or I don't know if you've ever seen the Gregory Peck film Scarlet and the Black, about the Vatican's attempt to get Jews out of out of Italy and into safety with the Monsignor Hugo Flattery. He's played by Peck in the film, and Christopher Plummer plays Herbert Kappler. And Kappler is a nasty piece of work as the SS Oberfuhrer of Rome, and knows that something's up, but he just can't quite get at it. And at the end, when the Allies come in, and he spends the rest of his life as a prisoner of war, and put up for. He didn't go to the Nuremberg trials, but the equivalent of Father Hugh visits him pretty much every week for the rest of his life until he's baptized.
So
acts of grace like that are definitely relevant to this, aren't they? I mean, there's a wonderful there's a video actually of which I watched, and I can't find it now, which was one of the police shootings that happened in America a few years ago, where an off-duty police lady went into the wrong flat and then shot the man who was there, and he's black, and she got a murder conviction, and the man's brother at the trial hugged her and said, I want you to know forgiveness. I don't want you to go to prison. I don't want you to suffer. I want you to know the forgiveness of Christ. Now, that is a powerful countercultural moment, because the society doesn't really know forgiveness like that. Society, certainly sort of growing the way things are going, it doesn't know why you would even do that. What's the benefit? There is none.
It's rooted in the heart of the gospel, isn't it?
Which exactly. Is exactly. He's a Christian. I want you to go to church. I want you to know Christ. I don't want you to be, I don't want you to be in this place. It's entirely gospel. It's entirely countercultural, and it's a radical way to treat those who have done us wrong.
Yeah. Gordon Wilson, in Enniskin, and I'd forgotten, it's Gordon Wilson. He became a great peace campaign. It was his daughter Marie who was killed in 86, I think. Yeah. Which I think compares horrifically with I'm trying to remember the name of the, there was this guy in America who went up in a McDonald's and got a wrong, he didn't get the burger he wanted, and he'd had a really bad day, so he threw it at one of the baristas or whatever, and it all ended up spiraling out of control, and a social media campaign brought him down. It was all videoed, and he ends up taking his life.
Really? Yeah.
Because everyone is isolated from him. They find him dead, apparently, in his car. They reckon he'd been dead for like a week in his car on his own.
Mm.
And it became one of these stories which said, maybe this is... there's a profundity here in how easy it is for us to turn everything upside down, really, in the wrong way.
Mm. Yeah, I think that in this age we're living in at the moment, to put it in religious terms, I think there's a kind of Manichaeanism which is at work. I was saying earlier about this thing about dividing humanity into sort of light and dark, good and evil. It's that way of thinking about things where, if you're even Christians do this. Well, because I'm a Christian, I'm good, and people who oppose Christianity and Christian values are bad, and therefore they must be denounced and opposed. And like you were saying, Tom, I think there is some truth in the fact that we have to combat wrong ideas and heresy and evil and wicked actions. But there's also a sense within the Christian message is that we are guilty and broken as individuals, and we need to be redeemed by Christ. And that has to be kept front and center throughout the entirety of the Christian life, doesn't it? And if you keep that front and center, it should give you a sort of humility and a grace when you're engaging with these sort of things, which is not, you know, it's not the way that sort of Manichaean cancel culture works. It's a completely graceless, I think it's like a twisted form of Christianity, really, because it takes things which are true, but it sort of twists them and it radicalizes them. It's all about, you know, the evil out there, and not about the evil that's within me. And as I say, Christians do this as well, and not just progressive Christians either, but conservative Christians do this. And I see quite a lot of it online from people who, you know, to be honest with you, have very similar political views to me. And I hope I don't do it myself. Maybe I'm even in danger of doing it right now. But it is definitely something to keep in mind. But I think we need to move on, and we should probably, since we're talking about cancel culture, we should probably talk about these stories that we've got here relating to this. So in Australia, this came across my desk earlier today. In Australia, this man, Andrew Thorburn, has had to resign as the CEO of a rugby football club? Is that what it is? Essendon. Because he is the chairman of a group of churches called the City on the Hill Movement. And it's come to light that, shockingly, the City on the Hill Movement are a Christian church who believe what the Bible says about things. Now, this is clearly unacceptable. Yeah. It's clearly unacceptable, and he's had to resign. Now, let's have a look and see what exactly was said by the church. A City on the Hill article from 2013. So a 9-year-old article, which has been dug up by somebody, titled Surviving Same-Sex Attraction as a Christian, advises those who struggle with same-sex attraction to speak to a mature Christian whom you can trust so you can receive the support and accountability you will need in long term to survive those temptations. Another sermon published in 2013 entitled What Christians Should Think About Abortion said, whereas today we look back at sadness and disgust over concentration camps. I wonder whether that's a typo. It probably should say, whereas today we look back with sadness and disgust over concentration camps, future generations will look back with sadness at the legal murder of hundreds of thousands of human beings every day through medicine and in the name of freedom. Dan Andrews, the Victorian Premier, has described these views as absolutely appalling. I saw a video earlier of him condemning bigotry and saying there's no place for it, no place for bigotry at all. It's got nothing to do with religious freedom. It's all about not having bigotry. And so Andrew Thorburn has had to resign, or at least he's decided to resign as the CEO of this rugby football club.
I'm just looking at the website for the church, actually. It's a very contemporary website, non-liturgical evangelical church. So it looks like they've got about 10 outlets in the locality. You know, it doesn't look any different from any sort of Holy Trinity Brompton sort of style
vineyard vineyard
church that you might have. And I suppose the belief system that you've just described, I mean, really it's not even technically, is it? How different is that from Orthodox Anglicanism, what's found in the prayer book? How different is that from the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, you know, traditional Lutheranism and so on? Are they not allowed to apply for these kind of posts either?
Yeah.
Let alone Muslim communities or, you know, strict Jews, etc.
Yeah. Asked how he would respond to a gay player challenging him on the church's views, Thorburn said, I would say thank you, and I respect and care about you, and you're welcome in this organization, and I want to hear what you think and to ensure that you feel safe and can speak out. So I want people to know who I am and how I lead and how I engage. That's what they should rely on. But the problem here is that he hasn't even said these views, that he holds these views as himself. The problem here is that he's associated with people who do not have the same views as the people who run the club. This statement from the club is interesting. This is not about vilifying anyone for their personal religious beliefs. Okay? But But about it's got nothing to do with his personal religious beliefs. But about a clear conflict of interest with an organisation whose views do not align at all with our values as a safe, inclusive, diverse and welcoming club for our staff, our players, our members, our fans, our partners and the wider community.
The conflict of interest is quite a technical thing, isn't it? It's like if you're on a board of a company and you also
you're right.
That the company is going to deal with, then there's obviously a conflict of interest or if your partner is, you know, owns the company, a company that they're going to deal with. So it's not a conflict of interest because there's no way that unless it must be said, unless either the church were planning to set up a football team or the football team were planning to set up a church, there is no conflict of interest.
Or in a wilder parallel universe, they were going to use City on a Hill for, you know, as a venue.
Yeah.
series of stadium like churches, you know. But
yeah,
conflict of interest. But
So it's not a conflict of interest at all.
We don't agree with your religious views. They should have any place in our organisation.
It's quite possible to have roles on the board of more than one organisation and to have a differing, like, you know, I mean, I don't really quite understand why the football club has an opinion about religion anyway. It shouldn't do, really. I mean, he's quite clear, you know, I'm sure that the church would want to call itself safe, inclusive and diverse as well, because we all do. You know, inclusive in the old-fashioned term rather than what it means, you know, all the...
This means the opposite of inclusive, doesn't it? Because he's not included. So I just don't understand how people can maintain that this is inclusive. I mean, it's so obviously exclusive.
And the irony is if you went back in time, say, 10, 20 years ago, when a lot of this is beginning to emerge, is that it's the progressive proponents were saying, we remember it, don't it? What were they saying? Oh, you know, there's a space for everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody can, you know, it doesn't matter if you believe in this or that. If you differ from us, you know, there'll always be space.
It's sort of related to Niehaus's kind of rule, isn't it? Where if orthodoxy is not optional. Or if orthodoxy is optional, it soon becomes repressed. You know. And it's kind of related to that, isn't it? These things cannot exist side by side because they're just fundamentally different ways of looking at the world. But it's hypocrisy is the problem here. Like I said, there's no reason why a Christian can't run a safe, diverse, inclusive, welcoming football club. There's no reason.
It's just an irrelevance, isn't it? Like if you have gay football players, it's just an irrelevance to running a football club. That's the thing is, I mean, well, that's the way it used to be seen anyway. The companies or organizations like sports teams, it's just not relevant to these kinds of entities to have, you know, an opinion about sexuality or religion. But now it's like football and sport and business and companies, they all need to be promoting some kind of social agenda. I mean, it's this stakeholder capitalism thing, isn't it? That it can't just be about producing a product or playing a sport. It's got to be about in some way improving society according to some ideology.
In other news, on that brief aside, the Mexican coffee farmers who've been subjected to some woke presentation on inclusivity as part of their coffee bean I don't know quite what the
what do they what are they what's their job do they oh, well, harvest actually, coffee beans
it's UK's climate aid money is paying for gender revision lessons for Mexican coffee growers. You can't just, you know, help out the Mexican coffee growers into a more sustainable sort of farming or whatever they're supposed to be doing. I don't know, you have to include gender revision lessons from some woke academic.
Well, that's not colonialist, is it?
I know, exactly. Yeah.
And the thing is, I bet if you got a Freedom of Information Act and asked how much that person coming over from, let's say, the UK to Mexico to deliver a PowerPoint is being paid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you saw once who worked within the department of whatever it is, that, you know, the charities department in government, and the money that is being wasted, that they'll be charging £10,000-£20,000 a day.
It's a complete waste of money.
And they'll be expecting the best hotels as well and first-class meals for that.
$11.6 billion, all of this is part of the UK's International Climate Finance Portfolio, in which the UK is investing $11.6 billion to March 2026. Apparently it's vital educational work among coffee growers in the state of Veracruz. Anyway, it's just another example of a project that just has to have. It's not just, I very much doubt the coffee growers, they really needed much help from our, great expertise in growing coffee that England's known for, of course. But quite apart from that, on top of that, they have to have imported Western woke ideas told to them.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen McAlpine has written a good piece on this this thing, and his argument is basically that Christians are too obsessed with this idea of winsomeness and trying to be sort of, you know, win the culture by not talking about sexuality and stuff like that. So he writes, safe, inclusive, diverse and welcoming according to a strict and narrow band. Except, of course, for those parts of the wider community who may disagree, with the secular age. I like that. So it's a nod to Charles Taylor's secular age there, but he's calling it the secular age. Yet still I hear from apologist Christians of the more progressive side of the faith that if only we'd shut up about sex, or if only we were more aligned with the social causes and less aligned with the culture wars, etc. So he's saying basically that we need to have a more robust engagement with these ideas rather than caving in to them, because the culture wants ultimately to have a kind of complete monopoly of ideas. So increasingly it will be more and more difficult for Christians to occupy a place in the public square. He writes, Rod Dreher didn't get everything right in the Benedict option, but those who scoffed at the notion that somehow Orthodox Christians would no longer be welcome in the public square and would have to set up alternate institutions in order to survive and thrive need to reassess their breezy optimism. Quite right. Quite right. And then he quotes...
As I said last week, I think a week before when I was on, I think there are certain professions now in the UK that Orthodox Christians would really struggle to have any foothold in, let alone get shortlisted.
Yeah, definitely. Resisting the urge to make some kind of comment about the episcopate.
Stephen McAlpine makes quite an interesting point in his previous article, which also covers the same stuff. I think news moved quicker than he could type almost. But he points out the City on the Hill, they're just an Anglican outreach church, they're an evangelical Anglican church.
Oh, are they Anglicans?
Yeah.
All right.
It's an Orthodox, non-revisionist church that preaches the Bible, loves Jesus, encourages people to love others. The point he's making is that until yesterday, suddenly all of the Google search, what he did is he searched for City on a Hill, and the word controversial, which is on one of the headlines, the AFL headline put it, controversial church. And that's literally only ever been called controversial as of yesterday. You know, before that, there's nothing, you know, nothing remotely controversial. The point is that when you call someone controversial, he says here, makes you sound like a spooky cult, makes you sound like you've got something to hide. Sounds like almost like those crazy Moonies church, you know, controversial. They're not. They're an Anglican church. They have Anglican understanding of the Bible. They have that's well in line with millions, billions of Christians around the world.
Well, there's that. Another, I mean, this other story we've got here on the kind of cancel culture side of things this happened in the UK. Mother of five, Carolyn Farrow, has been arrested in her home over online posts she put on Twitter this week. She was arrested by Surrey police over web content in the Guildford home. Now, it's kind of hard to know what it is exactly she's supposed to have done. So I've got a number of questions about this. So it seems like she was making some kind of gender critical tweets, as they say nowadays, and that she had sort of misgendered people. The police came into the house. They sort of forced their way into the house while she was cooking dinner in front of her children. And they started confiscating electronic devices. They said they didn't have a warrant for her arrest, but they arrested her anyway. And I just find this to be
is there something
very strange
of the police force going around at the moment? Because that's crazy, isn't it? Did you remember 2-3 years ago we were told by all these police spokesmen how tight resources were for catching criminals?
Yeah.
And yet they've got enough resources on a Sunday to go in and pull someone out.
Yeah.
Tweet for probably saying that, you know, men can't be pregnant.
Yeah,
dragging them out, as you know, aka Terry Gilliam's Brazil film. Dragging them out of their house, you know, still clinging on to the roast in the oven.
Her husband is a priest, a Roman Catholic priest, I think. And so, what
is the ordinariate?
Yeah, he must be. He must be former Anglican, mustn't he?
Former Anglican. I mean, I think it's a shocking story, isn't it? I mean, it's not quite clear what the police think she's done. There's some. They seem to have found some stuff someone's made a complaint, obviously, but it's not even entirely certain, according to Caroline, that it's in fact her writing it. You know, they haven't linked that to her. They forced their way into the house, which I did not think they could do actually without a warrant. We don't need a warrant. Push the door open. Now that I've done a little bit of research, there's some specific occasions where police can enter a house without a warrant. If they need to make a arrest for a very serious crime, that's one of them. If they suspect that someone's in danger, that's another one. But they're quite restrictive things. If they've been invited, that's another one. But they clearly weren't. You know, it seems a bit odd that they can just push their way in to seize, to make an arrest in order to seize her.
Are you saying, Tom, that had she slammed the door and locked herself in?
Well, she couldn't, could she? Because the policeman opened the door, they literally shoved the door open, didn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, she's only a slight woman. I mean, it's rather shocking. It's not a serious crime, even if she has done it.
It's not even a crime, is it? It's not a crime. She hasn't even been accused of anything.
She's been charged. Yeah, she has been charged.
She's been charged with
harassment and malicious communications. If the harassment Twitter argument is deemed to be motivated by someone's protected characteristics, up to 2 years imprisonment, apparently. But one thing, I don't think that gender is a protected characteristic if she was arguing with someone who is trans, because I think sex is but gender isn't. But anyway, it just seems shocking. She gave a good interview on on GB News, which is worth watching, to Mark Stein.
It's very disturbing, isn't it? I mean, it makes you think,
that door next to Tom and wondering, you know, will they?
Yeah. No, but I mean, in all seriousness, in all seriousness, like, you know, what, where is this going to end? So she's a Roman Catholic. Her husband's a Roman Catholic priest. They obviously homeschool their kids. And somebody's just made presumably some kind of anonymous complaint about stuff she's been saying online. And then the next minute, the police are literally forcing their way into her home and arresting her in front of her children.
Yeah.
I mean, this is insane what's going on. It's worrying as well. I mean, this could happen to any one of us or any Orthodox Christian in the country. If you express your views online in a way that people don't like, then apparently you can be arrested for it. I mean, this is news to me. I didn't realize this, that you could literally be arrested for, if somebody accuses you of harassing. I mean, what does it even mean to harass someone online? Presumably it was a Twitter exchange, it was a public Twitter exchange.
It's not very clear what exactly. I'm sure this sort of thing will come out in the wash. So there's interesting on her Twitter page, this chap called Adrian Yalland, and he says, it's less than a week since the Met Police settled my claim against them for its failings in the way they dealt with the attempts of a notorious trans rights activist to have me arrested, and less than 24 hours since the same activist had Caroline arrested by Surrey Police. So it's maybe that this is part of an ongoing thing, but it just seems, if so, even less believable, you know, akin to that sort of constant believing of the fantasist who slated everyone, you know, senior politicians everywhere, and the police took it incredibly seriously over and over again, despite the fact he was a well-known fantasist. I just don't know. It just, it seems shocking.
It is shocking. It's very shocking and worrying. We'll have to follow the story. Cool. Chaps, there's a couple of stories I just wanted to talk about. I mean, so we didn't mention anything to do with the budget over the last couple of weeks. And the reason I chose not really to talk about it is because I'm not very interested in it, and we didn't have very much time. I'm not necessarily suggesting we talk about it now, but just to mark what's happened. So basically, we got this new government with this new prime minister and new chancellor, and they came out with this mini budget, which lots of people hate because the top rate of tax was going to be reduced from 45% to 40%. And that seemed to be the main thing that people really hated, wasn't it? And then there were various other things as well, like changes to benefits and sort of complicated economic things. And now they've done a U-turn on the top rate of tax. So go on.
Yeah. So, I mean, just sort of for the vague understanding of the economics. So they are obviously what you might call Austrian school economics, sort of influenced, I guess, which is
that's associated with Hayek, isn't it?
Hayek rather than Keynes. And it's a sort of more to sort of right wing, small state, low tax, high growth economies that they're trying to kickstart the UK into again. The sort of reasoning behind the 40-45% thing, and it's not exactly that controversial. I mean, it's 40% before 2011, I think. So the whole of New Labour, you know, somehow the state finances survived being only 40% top rate of tax. You know, it's not like it's been 40% forever. I think it was the Tories with Nick Clegg who put it up to 50, didn't they?
Gordon Brown just before he left. Yeah.
And then Tories took it down.
Didn't they subsequently find that by having it at 50,
takings went down,
generated less money?
Yeah. So going down to 45% generated more money. And then the idea being that 40% would generate more money again. The reasoning being that it would attract more people on higher salaries back into the country. So you wouldn't do sort of tax dodges. You wouldn't go non-domicile in order to avoid paying high taxes. So, for example, there are loads of rich people in Scotland who might, if you have a lower high rate of income tax, just move down south of the border. That could bring in a lot of money for the Treasury quite rapidly. So that's called a Laffer curve, I believe. The idea that the more you tax, the less, after a certain point, the more you tax, the less money you get. Mm. It's not uncontroversial, but it's also not unsupported. You know, it's one of those ones that economists argue about. Some economic people believe that it's not true. Others do. But I mean, it certainly seemed to work for the coalition government. They say they did get more money by dropping the higher tax rate. So the idea of the budget, I think, is to try and set loose supply side reforms so that the economy starts going again. And it's up to sort of pump the economy to get it going again, because at the current we've got very low productivity, we've got very low we've got very low supply side problems, which are pushing inflation. Inflation, of course, is a two-sided equation. On one side, you get inflation if there's too much cash flowing around. On the other side, you get inflation if there's not enough goods flowing around. So the idea is to pump start the good side. I think that's what they're doing anyway. And most of it's not that controversial, really. One of the controversial things is borrowing to more to try and get that going. The idea being, in the long run, that the size of the economy will grow, so that the percentage of our national debt will shrink compared to the increased size of the economy. Which is, again, it's the opposite of us. So when it's quite funny, because when austerity came in, everyone was saying that, you know, you don't want to cut the size of the state. It's a bad idea because, you know, what you want to do is grow your way out of debt problems. And now some people come in and try and do that. And the media are saying, oh, no, we don't want to grow your way out. We need austerity. We need austerity. I don't know. I'm not an economist. I can see the arguments of both sides. I think probably there's a lot of hysteria going on, certainly a sort of attack on right-wing idea of a small state and low taxes as an acceptable way of going forward. I quite like low taxes because the more you tax, the less choice you have with your money, in effect.
I think, Tom, just to jump in here, but I think the issue is, so just a couple of things. So there's clearly been a profound lack of wisdom in the way that the government have gone about this, even if it's sound economic policy. You know, they've just come in. I mean, it's like the first rule of leadership, isn't it? That when you take over in a new place, you don't like make massive widespread changes without consultation, time, sounding things out.
Yeah, but do they have time?
It's been profound. It was profoundly poorly communicated.
Oh yeah, they said 90% of what they did, they said in the leadership campaign. Like, it's not, shouldn't be that much of a surprise.
I think there were aspects of it which were very, very surprising to people, and it wasn't communicated. I mean, look, I didn't follow it very clearly, but I didn't see Liz Truss out there like up front and center to begin with. You know, being really confident, being in the public eye. She wasn't really around very much at all during that first part. And the other thing, which I think is, and I think this is the sort of more interesting thing, which is the sort of moral question, is regardless of whether or not you agree with this, this has made it so easy for the political opposition to say, look, these Tories, all they care about is giving rich people tax cuts. And we know, of course, that Kwasi Kwarteng, just after he'd announced the budget, went to some kind of champagne reception, didn't he, with a load of hedge fund managers who are going to benefit from this. So there's the perception, there's the optics of it, and then there's a moral question as well, which is about it's so bad when you think about it. When you think about the rising energy costs, when you think about the price, you know, cost of living, price of food, all this kind of stuff, and the Tories, what they're doing is they're cutting the top rate of tax in order to give rich people a tax break. Now, as I agree that there's a much more complicated, subtle economic argument that can be made, but that's the perception. And that's also the moral question as well, which is it right to give rich people a tax break when poorer people are struggling so much? So one of the things I heard Keir Starmer say is, you know, if you apply this tax cut to somebody who's earning, I can't remember how much he said, I think it was maybe £1 million, then it's something like, what was it, 90 grand or something like that. Let's say it's 90 grand, 90 grand saving, which you could use to, you know, employ a nurse or something like that. Now, I'm not saying I necessarily agree with these arguments, but I certainly think you can make these arguments based on the optics of the situation. And that's what the problem is, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. I see it as a sort of an attack on a particular idea behind behind the current governments, and
can you see how some well-meaning people might see it as something else? Like that, yeah, it's not an ideological attack necessarily, or it could, in some cases obviously it is, but it's not necessarily an ideological attack on the idea of low taxation as a stimulus to growth, but it's a criticism of, yeah, of a political party that only cares about rich people and doesn't care about poor people.
But the point is that the rich people, you can get a lot of money out of them if you do it the right way. I mean, any tax cut at all is obviously going to give more money back to the rich people than the poor people to start with, because they're giving more to start with. If you just
But people look, I'm being a bit devil's advocate here, I know, but people who are in favor of redistribution of wealth say there shouldn't be tax cuts for rich people, they should be taxed more. And
if that makes less money, then you can't give more money to the poor people.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's
isn't this the problem with, particularly with a lot of hard left progressive ideology, is that we have to group people into these categories of the rich and the poor, rather than taking on the particular, and that the particular is that a tax cut will engender growth to the economy.
Well, that's the point.
And that will benefit everybody. Now, you know, if you take it the other way around, but if you don't allow for growth, then no one's going to grow. And that's not just trickle down. That's, I think, just reality. I mean, this is why you can have these sort of communist paradises. And I saw them in Yugoslavia, where the shops are empty because no one's bothered and there's no economy.
Mm. There's nothing to motivate people to produce wealth.
I have to say, I think maybe we'll shoot me down, but I think taxing anyone at 40%, there's a problem in an economy if you've got to do that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I do. I do completely agree with this. And I'm actually reading through quite slowly. I'm reading through The Road to Serfdom at the moment, which is by Hayek, who's, you know, is clearly influential in this discussion. I do accept all of that. I honestly do. But having said that, I do think the way that Kwesi Kwarteng has conducted himself is really sleazy. You know, going to this champagne reception after.
It's rather silly of him, isn't it? But I mean, this is all optics. I don't really care about optics.
No, it's not. I don't think it is just optics. I think it's about the Tory party and the way they get their money. You know, these people donate to the Tory party. It's a mutually beneficial arrangement, isn't it? You know, they cut tax, and these people donate more money. You know, I mean, that can be true at the same time as, you know, the argument that this is sound economics. And I think it probably is true, if I'm honest with you. And, you know, I remember Kwarteng, I can't remember exactly what his role was during the lockdown, but I remember him saying stuff like justifying the limitations on mourners at funerals in this absolutely, completely disingenuous, a deceitful way. And I remember being so angry at the time, you know, having to be at funerals where, you know, mourners were literally standing outside church buildings, not able to go in and attend the funeral of a family member because there was these ridiculous caps on numbers. And Kwarteng, you know, sort of blithely tweeting out about this with this, you know, these deceitful justifications for why it was necessary. I just remember that, you know, and I can't look at this and think, well, this is just a person who sort of, you know, who has these kind of beneficent motivations to grow the economy. I think he's a careerist like the rest of the contemporary Tory party.
Well, again, can't both be true. I mean,
they can.
They do want to grow the economy, because if we don't grow the economy, then we will stagnate. And there'll be a decline in living standards. I mean, especially as the, you know, I mean, to be honest, I suspect this will all be rather. So I've read some things which suggest, on the one hand, that this is actually effectively what they're doing is tightening monetary policy and loosening fiscal policy, which I think, as I understand, monetary policy is the sort of central banks, and fiscal policy is the economy, and the two interreact. So that I think we will see other changes as well, and I suspect we're also, what we're going to see is some trimming of the state as well in order to fund some of these unfunded tax cuts, and the two sides should in the end help, because we're channeling like way too much of this country GDP to a monolithic and inefficient state. It's, you know,
56% of money is channeled through. That's dreamland for the old Soviet states.
Yeah. Well, there's not very, very much sign of that though, Tom, is it? I mean, the government expenditure hasn't been cut.
They've said they will be doing that later because
they did need to do it later.
They did need to do so quickly because inflation is taking off. And I suspect we'll see the Bank of England increase the base rate of inflation again soon. I mean, that's the main reason. At least this chap on Money Week, Max King, he argues that the reason that we've seen deflation in the value of sterling is because the US banks are hiking their rates aggressively and the Bank of England isn't. So it makes the dollar more attractive as an investment. I
read that as well, Tom, and I'm not an economist, so I don't really know whether that's a sound argument or not. It just sounded to me to be sort of quite, I don't know, a bit spurious. I wasn't sure whether I bought that. One of the things I did like is I listened to an interview with Liz Truss, which was on Sunday, I think, and I forget who it was with, but basically she was asked, Laura Kunzberg? Yeah. So she was asked, are you absolutely committed to this 5% tax cut from the top rate of tax? And she said, yes. And I was really pleased about that because I like it when a politician gives a straight answer. You know, she actually answered the question. She didn't try and get around it. And then the following day, they did a U-turn. I mean, it's so disappointing. You know, when you have somebody who's actually straight talking, you think, well, you know, come on, let's follow through with this now and go for it. You're going to say you're going to do it. And then it makes you look disingenuous, because the only reason you're going back on it is because it's politically. But I mean, I guess maybe you'd say, well, there would be a rebellion in the House of Commons and it wouldn't go through and blah, blah, blah. But it just makes you look, it's embarrassing, isn't it? It's embarrassing for them.
Yeah. And I think it's fatally wounded the government, actually, probably even in the sort of third week of their existence.
Are we going to have Rishi? By this time next week, is Rishi going to be the prime minister, do you think? Or not next week,
I just think, you know, there's already talk about other mini rebellions, about various things. They've sensed weakness, and now those who disliked the sort of fiscal and monetary policies of the people they elected in the end, I can sense that even within the Tory party, can sense the weakness. And
Gove's been on manoeuvres, hasn't he? He's been doing some stuff. He's been giving some interviews talking about how he's not happy. Yeah, the Dark Lord has been talking about he wasn't happy about the tax cut, and now he's not happy about the budgetary arrangements. So he's making his move, I think. Could be Gove. Could be Rishi.
But the thing is, if they once again get the knives out for another, eventually you won't end up with you'd end up with an election and a loss. I mean, it's probably where this is going anyway.
It seems that way, doesn't it?
Which means we end up with, the joys of a Keir Starmer administration, which would be seriously bad. Even against all of these things, it would be seriously bad.
The cold, dark winds of socialism blowing across this country once again.
Yeah.
John Lithgow channeling Jamie Franklin channeling John Lithgow channeling Winston Churchill in The Crown there, for anyone who's unclear about what the reference was.
What was that wonderful quote that went on one of our groups about with Boris gone, the ringmaster has been taken out and now the lions are going for the clowns?
That's a really good quote. That's really good. Hey, chaps, we should do some question of the rev. We're going to have to miss some stuff we were planning on doing because we've, as always, just got too much to say, too much wisdom to impart. So what we're going to do now is some of the question of the rev. And I'm clearly just flanneling because I'm trying to get the theme tune up. But here it is right now. Can you hear it? It's not loud enough, is it? Here we go. Let's turn it up. Daniel and Thomas, welcome along to this edition of Question the Rev. We've been recording the podcast for about an hour now already, so you should be familiar with the process. I put this up on Twitter today just for a bit of variety. The first question is a bit left field. It's from an account called Fear is the Mind Killer, which is, I approve of the sentiment. Fear is the mind killer.
It's a quote from June. Yeah.
Oh, is it? Okay. Right. Well, there we go. I'm assuming this is a male, but I could be wrong.
Tom.
This is not about June.
Death. Yeah.
He writes, how big of a role should songwriting be for a music minister in a church? How important are new songs to a congregation? Interesting. We kind of had a little backwards and forwards about this, didn't we, Tom? You used to be a music minister, didn't you?
Well, I guess you could have called me a music minister. I didn't really write songs that much, or if I ever. I wrote other music. never really had it performed in church. No, I did actually. I did once or twice. I wrote a few settings of psalms, things like that, which we used. And the Beatles.
Nice.
How big of a role? I don't really know. I mean, it sounds like a question for a job applicant rather than for a theologian.
I would have thought that this isn't something I have experience with, but I would have thought that songwriting for a music minister in a church should be quite a big role, shouldn't it? I mean, it sounds like...
I don't know. Well, it depends. If you've got J.S. Bach and he's contracted to put in, you know, a cantata a week to fill the liturgy out, that's one thing. But if you've just got someone whose job is to lead worship, I don't know.
But come on. I mean, I don't want to be down on people who lead worship in that evangelical, charismatic way. But if you've got a full-time job being a music minister, it's not going to take you all day to work out, you know, what your set's going to be, is it? You've surely got loads of time to write music. You're just there with your acoustic guitar.
It's not always a skill, is it? It's not a skill of everyone. Anyway, yeah, I don't know, Jerry. I just don't know.
I think that there is a question about theology here.
Mm.
That, you know, Augustine says, he who sings prays twice, that there's always a danger that we just introduce songs willy-nilly. And I think the Eastern Church goes to the opposite extreme, doesn't it? It would take almost an ecumenical council on their part to add anything at all to the text. Whereas we'll have, you know, hymn sandwiches left, right and centre. And people might have composed something or will play something, or, you know, it could be anything from a 19th century hymn to something Hillsongy you might find in any Anglican church up and down the country. I worry sometimes about the theology behind some of those songs and what they communicate. You know, for instance, Wild Goose, some of the music's lovely. This is from the Iona community.
Wild Goose?
Wild Goose, some of the
music. What's that?
It's a music publisher.
Oh.
Wild Goose is inspired by John Bell from the Iona community's. And some of the sentiments in that are I'm not too comfortable with.
Mm.
Now, you know, you can look at also music, say, that came out post-Vatican II in the Roman Catholic Church. There are a number of hymns which completely changed the way that hymns normally operate, which put the singer, like I, the Lord of Sea and Sky, I always wonder about that one. You know, in many ways, lovely sentiments, but what am I doing singing in the voice of God? You know, here I am, Lord, in that chorus, you know.
It flips
kind of needy.
Well, so one minute you're God, and then the next minute you're you.
I
think we'll get told off.
I'm just saying, I think songwriting is we've actually undervalued it, and I think we're a bit wishy-washy and willy-nilly about the way we allow music to just fall into church worship.
I certainly think that you can tell a 20th century hymn. I mean, I'm not talking about worship songs. There's some really good worship songs. We were told off on Telegram by someone for being dismissive about worship songs a few weeks ago. I think we commented about I'm coming back to the heart of worship. It's all about you, Jesus, which...
I still think you were right in what you said, to be honest. I don't take it back.
Neither do
sorry.
I.
I maintain what I said, and the tone in which I said it.
But the 20th century hymns. Now there are some really good ones, 21st century, but there are some really poor ones, and just sort of the poets seem to have lost the knack for good poetry. Or of course, the other thing is that, I mean, you know, there are lots of really bad Victorian hymns that never get sung these days because they're awful. And
only the good ones get remembered.
The good ones get remembered. So, you know, but unfortunately, like 40% of hymns old and new seems to be awful rewrites of using words for classic hymn tunes.
Terrible stuff. There's some terrible stuff out there.
For the medieval church, banned carols. You know, carols were not to be sung in the liturgy. But now they're sort of in the mainstream of our Christmas liturgies. And then later on, you know, you sort of got Victorian sentiment. I mean, away in a manger. If you analyze the words, actually, it's so drippy and almost deceitist in its approach that, you know, Jesus is this perfect baby that doesn't poo or cry. I mean, that seems to be denying an aspect of the incarnation.
Yeah, it's denying the humanity of Christ, isn't it? It's kind of, it's a, I forget, I can't, I'm not awake enough. Docetism is that he seems to be human, isn't it? That's how I remember. So maybe that one.
Most of them are fairly I mean, they're
I know they're great. They're great Christmas carols. We're not going to slag Christmas carols off, surely. The serious point is that this one of the great things about the Reformation, isn't it, is that it gave hymnody back to the people. And of course, the Anglican Church plays a part in that as well with hymn writers like Charles Wesley, for example. But anyway, we could talk about hymns all day. I want to do another question.
Oh,
if that's right.
Question.
This relates. This one says, "Do you?" This is by David Granville, but he's got a picture of a woman in his profile, unless he's a man in drag. So I'm confused. I don't know what to say. Do you believe what the Bible says about the earth being flat, motionless, and covered by the firmament? Now, chaps, before you come in here, I take this as an opportunity to recommend a book I just read, which is called Of Popes and Unicorns: Science, Christianity, and How the Conflict Thesis Fooled the World. I've just got the sleeve here because I took it off so the book wouldn't get damaged when I was taking it around. It's by David Hutchings and James Ungaranu. But it's really interesting, actually, when you look at the history of this idea, you know, that the sort of myth that Christians taught that the earth was flat. The people who propagated that idea in the 19th century really got it from two obscure Christian authors. One was Cosmas, and the other one is called Lactantius, I think. But people you've never heard of, you know, not St. Augustine or Thomas Aquinas. There's no tradition within Christian early Christian theology or medieval Christian theology of anyone serious saying.
Quite the reverse, actually. So if we look at scholastic cosmology, the ideas of the of the Earth's place within the universe are quite nuanced.
Yeah.
Within the pre-Copernican system, you know, where the Earth is the centre, the sense of the spherical nature of the planet is definitely there. You can see it in the maps and the drawings.
Well, even the notion of the centre, Daniel, in the kind of medieval system. The earth wasn't thought to be in the center in terms of its place of importance. It was actually completely opposite. It was completely opposite way around. Is that heaven is the center and earth is a kind of outlier because it's far away from the heavenly sphere.
Further in C.S. Lewis, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And the spheres of influence, the heavenly spheres that St. Paul speaks of in the medieval, that the later on get translated in the medieval cosmology come out in all sorts of funny ways, like the influenza, isn't it? Is the influence of the moon sphere on the earth, and we're all very familiar with influenza in the last 2.5 years. There's a lot more there, and I think part of the problem is that since the Enlightenment we've got rid of this enchanted vision, this beautiful Christian enchanted vision of reality for something else, and as Christians I think we've struggled to replace it with anything that compares.
I agree with that. And the other thing I'd say about this as well is when it says, you know, do you believe what the Bible says about X, Y, and Z, and I don't know, this person would have to give some specific verses, but I think what you have to say to that is when you know it says in the Psalm something like, you know, he has made the round world fast so that it can't be moved or whatever it is, you don't have to read that like it's making some kind of objective scientific pronouncement about the fact that the earth doesn't move. It's talking about our perception of our environment, right? So people just didn't even think in that way at the time. They weren't trying to make some kind of comment about, you know, the cosmology in that specific scientific sense.
I'm not sure the exact translation on that psalm, but I suspect in the Septuagint, the Greek translation, it would use the word cosmos.
Right.
So the world, when Christ and St. John talk about the world, he actually uses the word cosmos, which then gives a completely different take on it.
Yeah,
so loved the cosmos that he gave.
Daniel, just to be absolutely clear then, so the way you would read that is you would say he has made, you know, everything reality so that it can't be moved or something like that. So it's actually making then a sort of existential point or a metaphysical point or something.
Yeah, which goes right back to Adam and Eve. You can't change the universe to make it in your own because you don't like the rules. You know, you can't to your will.
Yeah.
The only way you're going to flourish is if you understand the order of things.
Yeah. On the subject of the flat earth, I did actually listen to a germ warfare podcast with a flat earther who was very, very passionate. And you know me, I'm a very, very open-minded guy. And I was really trying to sort of get into the headspace of somebody who genuinely believes the earth is flat. And I even watched a video of some Christian flat earthers as well. But I have to say, I find it very, very unconvincing from a biblical perspective and just from a sort of common sense perspective as well. It's just like you'd have to believe that all the pilots who fly around the world are somehow mistaken about what they're doing or they're lying, or, you know, I don't really get that. I don't think the earth is flat. I don't know what you guys think, but that's just what I think. Tom, do you have something to say?
I like Jonathan Pageau quote, the earth is flat most of the time.
Yeah, well, that's true, isn't it? The earth's flat for us, apart from when you come to the hill or a valley.
Our lived experience of living in the modern world, that everything feels flat.
Yeah.
I think you guys have covered it, really. There's no biblical mandate, strictly speaking, for a flat earth or for a stationary earth. It's not necessary to read the Bible in that way. It's quite possible to read the Bible as being reasonably concordant with some sort of idea of a vast universe made of heavenly bodies that are orbiting each other according to gravity. I don't see any contradiction.
Yeah, I think this is the thing, is like people, I mean, there is a serious issue, isn't it? Because people are, I think the experience of COVID has made people question authority in a more general sense. And I do understand that. And I think in some cases it's a really positive thing. But I do think also that if you go too far in that direction, you can find yourself in a very strange and dark place. And I think you can be so open-minded. I mean, this is not a phrase I've made up, but you can be so open-minded that your brain falls out. There are some things which should simply be accepted because they have been demonstrated conclusively to be true. And I would say that the fact that the world is round, and you know that there's the, you know, space with all the planets and the stars, I think that's pretty conclusive. Now, it might be that some of the things that are being said currently are wrong, or that they need to be altered or whatever. But I think that basic fact is, I don't really see how you can plausibly argue against it. I know lots of people do, but I think it must be to a certain extent a kind of a pathology that is committed to the principle that consensus on these matters must by definition be wrong. And that's not a sound epistemological principle at all. Should we do one more? Finish off?
I've got to go in a moment, but go on quickly.
All right, now, well, let's not then, because they're quite serious. These are quite serious questions.
One person
says, are there any official figures regarding church attendance since the end of the lockdown? Has it increased? The only thing I heard on this was that report that was ages ago, about 6 or 9 months ago, saying about how the Church of England was estimating a 20% decline in congregational numbers. I don't know whether you two, have either of you seen anything?
I thought it was 40, but I might be wrong.
40%?
There's a census every year, isn't there? So I don't know when they release it. Around Easter, is it around Easter? Is it around Easter? They also take in October as a month as well in Easter Diocese for the parish.
It used to be that in there was a priest in Exeter who headed up the national stats group. So they were very keen in Exeter to get the data right.
Right.
So it will be interesting to see what has emerged. Anecdotally, I've heard that youth services really struggled to reboot post-COVID. And I think, again, this is just a broader impression. I've noted that when you visit a lot of churches, sort of market town churches, whereas, you know, 60... pre-COVID attendance on a Sunday Eucharist might be in the sort of, you know, sort of mid 60s. It's now more normative to talk about 30s.
I suppose it depends, doesn't it, on what kind of church it is and the profile and everything like that. I mean, I can't believe that it's done anything good for the church to have shut down. And I think the principle is that lots of fringe people are being lost, aren't they? That's the thing. I mean, we haven't seen decline at all, but we have lost some people who were on the fringes of the church who just, you know, we just haven't seen them again.
Yeah, got out the habit of coming.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, with young people as well, you know, who are, you know, now they're into, you know, whatever it is young people are into these days, you know, Netflix or Minecraft or, you know, GTA 4 or whatever it is. Yeah, I know all this stuff. I know what their kids are into.
You're down, are you?
I know what they're into. And I they don't use the word down, I can tell you that.
Some of them have this deep, deep, dark secret, Jamie.
Irreverent. They're into irreverent. Yeah, we actually have some school kids listen to this show, which we welcome all our junior listeners, by the way.
Family friendly outfit we are.
Of course we are. The sooner kids get engaged with theology and philosophy and politics, the sooner they can start reading Charles Taylor and Anglican Theology by J.A. Franklin.
And a light reading of...
yeah, exactly. All right, we should finish. If anyone's got any stats, by the way, you can always send them to us, irreverendpod@gmail.com, or anything at all, you can send us an email. Send us an email at irreverendpod@gmail.com. All our stuff is on our website, reverendpod.com, ways to support social media, etc. But now it's time to say goodbye. So goodbye to you, Daniel and Tom.
Goodbye. Bless you.
And it's also goodbye from me. Goodbye now.